Welcome to Christ the Center, your weekly conversation of Reformed theology. We're now on episode number 599, getting close to that 600 mark, which we'll hit next week, Lord willing. My name is Camden Busey. I serve as the pastor of Hope Orthodox Presbyterian Church in Grays Lake, Illinois. And of course, we're back with another Christ the Center episode and another good conversation lined up for us today. Let me introduce to you our regular. We have Jim Cassidy, who's pastor of South Austin OPC in South Austin, Texas. Welcome back, Jim. It's great to see you again.
As always, Camden, great to be here today.
Yeah, thanks for joining us. Looking good. Got a new light there, so the webcam is looking nice and sharp today. We're really appreciative of you joining us and looking forward to the conversation today. We have a fun one. Today, our guest is none other than Jeffrey S. McDonald. Jeff is a pastor of Avery Presbyterian Church, an EPC congregation in Bellevue, Nebraska. He also serves as an affiliate professor of church history at Sioux Falls Seminary in Omaha, and he's the author of a new book we'll talk about in a minute, but let me welcome you, Jeff. It's great to talk to you today.
Well, I'm so thankful for you guys having me on and just honored to be here.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Jeff's the author of John Gerstner and the Renewal of Presbyterian and Reformed Evangelicalism in Modern America. You can find that published by Pickwick Publications, 2017. It's part of the Princeton Theological Monograph series, and if you'd like to check out that book or other books in the series, you can find them online and download them, information about them, and also find the books wherever, of course, good historical books are sold. So we're going to have a great conversation today talking about John Gerstner and his history and his legacy and the importance of him and the way the Lord used him in terms of shaping and revitalizing Reformed and Presbyterian evangelicalism in the U.S. in recent times. But before we do that, we've got a few things to mention. I do want to stop and pause to talk about our conference coming up in October. Of course, if you head on over to reformforum.org/conference, you'll find information about our annual theology conference. This will be our sixth annual theology conference. It's going to be October 11th through 13th at Hope OPC in Grays Lake, where we've had our annual conference every year, so our sixth in a row. And we keep learning every year and tweaking things and trying to get the events scheduled just right and time everything appropriately. Also trying to keep it rather affordable. We will have a VIP dinner again this year. I'm planning on hosting that again at Market House in the Square as we've had it the last 2 years, and Jim can testify that this is a wonderful time and a wonderful place. So we'll have that VIP dinner on Friday night as we've had in the last couple of years. Then we'll have the main conference contained all the way to be a full-day conference on Saturday, with enough time for people to go out and spend some time at dinner together if they'd like. And we usually have a themed Sunday school lesson on Sunday morning right after the worship service for those who are able to stay and to worship with us on Sunday. But if you need to get home, there's certainly, if you're within the area, plenty of time on Sunday evening or Saturday evening to get home and in time to prepare for the Lord's Day on the 13th. But if you'd like more information, check us out at reformedforum.org/conference. You can also find the events menu at the top of our website and find 2019 Theology Conference. The subject this year is The Law is Spiritual, which is a phrase out of Romans 7:14, subtitle something to the effect of the goal of God's law from creation to consummation. So we're continuing on developing the themes we've been developing for the last 6 years at our conferences, and we hope to have Lane Tipton, Jeff Waddington, and Glenn Clary speaking, and I'll be doing the intro and the outro, so we're looking forward to all that. Information and schedule online, and registration, if it's not up already, should be up very soon. So check us out again, reformedforum.org/conference. The Wimberley Conference recordings should be out hopefully in the fall. Again, we've been working hard at developing a video curriculum. As Lane Tipton talked and taught about the foundations of covenant theology, we explored some of those early chapters of Genesis and what they meant for these covenantal foundations and for worship and for man's place within the world and our relationship with God. That came out very well. It's looking very good. Jim, I don't know if you had an opportunity to look at one of the videos I sent over to you. But basically, we have the edited and color-corrected videos, and we can still tweak some of the edits. But We're working on adding graphics and also working on a leader's guide and study questions and whatnot to package that all up and make it available to churches, hopefully this fall. So, Jim, what did you think of what you saw?
It already looked amazing. I was surprised. It looked better than it looked when I was there.
Oh, sure. Yeah. You were looking at log format. So for the videographers out there, you know, we're looking at rough footage and now it's been color graded and color corrected everything. So it's looking good. James Lee has done a great job.
It looked fantastic. And what I meant was that it looked even better than watching
it in person. Yeah. It's like hyper real.
It's better than the real thing. Yeah. I mean, they really did a great job, capturing Dr. Tipton's teaching. And as we know, he is an incredibly gifted teacher. And especially when he gets into that element where he can just let it rip, he's wonderful. And
he really had the freedom to move and everything. And that was captured. They had three camera angles. And camera movement. I mean, these are pros that were doing it, and it shows. They've done a great job. So we're happy to have recorded and captured, an excellent course, and to deliver it in a medium and a format that is suitable to the quality of the class. You don't want, you want great teaching, and that's the most important thing. But if you have great teaching and it's terrible audio or terrible video, doesn't look good, it's not appealing, then that's no good. It's harder. It's a barrier to listen and to learn. Likewise, if you have junk teaching, but it looks great and you're going to fool people or whatever. So we've always wanted, Lane's excellent teaching in his course to be delivered in a manner that's suitable and fitting for what he gave to us in terms of how he taught. And so I think we've accomplished that. So we're working on finalizing a lot of these things and making them available to churches and to individuals, hopefully in the fall. We're working hard. So take a look at that. You can subscribe to our email list if you'd like, the bottom of our webpage. You can also just keep listening and we'll keep people updated. You can also find us on Twitter and Facebook and all the usual places if you'd like to get information about what's going on here at Reformed Forum. All right. Well, I think enough of the housekeeping, but let's get to our main subject today. I'm excited about this. We're going to be talking about John Gerstner and the renewal of Presbyterian and Reformed Evangelicalism in Modern America. Again, this book published by Pickwick Publications 2017 in the Princeton Theological Monograph Series, written by our guest today, Jeff McDonald. Jeff, I'd like to open up at least and talk about John Gerstner more generally and about your interest in Gerstner, but if I might preempt that, Jim had some interest in a little connection with Gerstner he wanted to prompt us with, and I think that might be a good place to launch from. Jim?
Yeah, so my connection to Dr. Gerstner's is mediated. It's not a direct connection, but I'll always remember my 4.5 years pastoring in Johnstown, Pennsylvania. And I'm sure Jeff has come across all this information in his research about Dr. Gerstner's life. But there was a time after he left the mainline church and joined the PCA that for a period of time at the end of his life, he served as an associate pastor at a PCA church in Johnstown, Pennsylvania. And there was an unfortunate split. I won't go into the details of all of that. But anyway, out of that division, an OPC congregation was formed, and Dr. Gerstner urged that group that they couldn't stay independent very long. And you could just imagine him with his gruff voice telling this group that they can't be independent and you have to join a denomination, and
right.
and long and short of it is they eventually ended up in the OPC. And I came along as their second pastor. Their first pastor, our listeners who are really familiar with us will really appreciate this. Their first pastor was Danny Olinger, and I was their second pastor. So this group was nurtured by Dr. Gerstner. They come into the OPC, and their first two pastors are flaming Vantillians. me and Danny Longer. And you could just imagine. Well, anyway, the group was the group has now been dissolved. It's no longer a church, but just very, very wonderful, sweet Christian people that I had the privilege of pastoring. They pastored me as well. They were very, very receptive of the word and cared for me, my family, and my first pastorate very, very well. But boy, you could imagine the conversations, the spirited conversations that I had with the other elders in that congregation about apologetics, because they were such passionate passionate disciples of Dr. Gerstner. They just loved him, and the stories they told about his love and care for them is just absolutely amazing. And so this is a remarkable man from everything I have heard. And when I heard this book come out, I was pleasantly surprised to hear of a biography being written about Dr. Gerstner, and picked it up. And Jeff did a great job writing this book.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Jeff, what's been your experience with Dr. Gerstner? What led you into an extended research project and even writing now this monograph on him? Tell us a little bit about your own personal history.
Yeah. Well, I grew up in the PCUSA, and my
Me too.
Father has been a PCUSA pastor here in Omaha for about a little over 25 years now. He's an associate pastor at a church, and then that church is now EPC. I joined the EPC about 10 years ago. But when I was a freshman in college, I ran across Machen's book, Christianity and Liberalism. And that book was just so helpful, just in understanding the Christian faith, and just, you know, love that book and still, you know, think very highly of that book, and just really... my college years really came to, you know, admire Machen a lot. And then when I was in seminary, I went to, graduated from Wheaton College, and I went to seminary at Dubuque Seminary, that's where my father went as well. And, there I, read a book by Don McLeod called, W. Stanford Reed, an Evangelical Calvinist in the Academy. And as you know, Stanford Reed was a student of Machen and an evangelical Canadian Presbyterian historian at McGill University and at the University of Guelph. And that book is just outstanding. It's an inspiring book, and just I can't say enough positive things about Don's biography of Stanford Reed. But that started to cause me to think about, is there someone similar to Stanford Reed, you know, that I could write on here, you know, in America, that, you know, someone who was, you know, conservative, evangelical, you know, Presbyterian historian. And I thought about John Gerstner and did a MA program in history at the University of Nebraska, Omaha, and then applied to the University of Stirling and in Scotland, and wrote my dissertation on John Gerstner with David Bebbington, who's a historian there at Stirling. So that's kind of what led me to write on Gerstner. And I would say too, in terms of, at the time going through all this, I was PCUSA, and, I just really felt that Gerstner, had been marginalized, and even marginalized by a lot of, evangelicals in the PCUSA. A lot of people didn't really know too much about him, even within the renewal movements. I mean, there's some mention of him, but not a lot. So I just felt that Gerstner is someone that really, you know, had been severely neglected. And then also, if you look at, there's two histories of Pittsburgh Seminary. There's the Walter edited volume, and Gerstner receives no mention in that book, published by Erdmans, even though he spent many, many decades at the seminary and was a prominent figure in the seminary's history, received no mention. And then in the Don McKim volume, which is, both those books are good, but Gerstner is just, He shows up in one small place in the McKim volume. And so I just felt that something more needs to be done with John Gerstner. And if you just look at his career, he was involved in so many important events and controversies, and you know, in terms of the PCA and in the North, you know, in Western Pennsylvania, his, you know, former students got that started, you know, the Ascension Presbytery with R.C. Sproul and his involvement in Ligonier and his, you know, his prosecution of Mansfield Casement and the mainline church that led to the founding of the EPC in 1981. And he just, I think, is someone who deserves a lot more attention, and I think is, you know, not given enough credit for really standing firm for biblical truth.
Mm-hmm.
And really kind of continuing Machen's fights, you know, out into the second half of the 20th century. I think a lot of the work that he did really continued those important discussions and debates and controversies, continued them in the 20th, second half of the 20th century. So I think, you know, Gerstner, and the other thing, the other part of this too, is that the UPCNA denomination and people associated with it have been severely neglected also within the field of Presbyterian history. And it's, you know, Gerstner was a mainline Presbyterian church historian, but before that, you know, he was the last seminary church historian for the UPCNA, you know, which was a more evangelical Calvinist denomination that merged with the PCUSA in 1958. So then I was able to dig into Machen's ties to the UPCNA, and I think by looking at those ties, I think that we can see that Machen is more important than historians have actually realized, because Machen developed relationships with UPCNA scholars at Xenia Seminary in St. Louis, founded the League of Evangelical Students with those UP scholars, and that was a very important, renewal organization. And there hasn't been anything about Machen's involvement in that group. And now I have a paper on the League of Evangelical Students, which existed from 1925 to 1943. But I think, you know, if we look too at the UPCNA scholars after 1958, they were the ones that started the International Council on Biblical Inerrancy. Gerstner was at the first meeting of that organization, along with R.C. Sproul. And then the person that founded the ICBI was a person coming out of the United Presbyterian Church, graduate of Sterling College, a guy named Jay Grimstead. So the UPCNA, I think, is you know, they're given very little credit, and yet I think they're far more influential than historians have realized. So I've just been thankful to get this book, you know, published and get Gerstner's story out there, and I think the book helps illuminate a lot of areas of our Presbyterian past.
Yeah, certainly does. And there is, it's a fascinating life, Dr. Gerstner, as you have portrayed it in the book. A lot of stuff that I didn't know. I knew a lot of the stuff already going in, knew his involvement with Ligonier, knew about his involvement with the Jonathan Edwards Study Center and the Yale edition of Edwards' books. I knew about his three-volume, The Rational Biblical Theology of Jonathan Edwards, knew about his involvement with the inerrancy stuff. So, but there a whole lot of stuff there I didn't realize. And particularly if I could, I have so many questions for you, Jeff, because the book was just, I got a page of questions that come out of the reading the book. So thought-provoking and stimulating. But let me, if I could, we're going to have to focus narrowly here. So, but let's maybe ramp up to stuff. And if you would, why don't you take us back to the beginning of Gerstner's life? I was surprised to find out that he didn't grow up in a Christian home. I just always had it in my mind. He was kind of a born and bred Presbyterian. That's not the case. Why don't you take us the early days of his life up through his education, right into Harvard University.
Sure. Well, you know, he grew up in Philadelphia, and his parents were not Christians. He said he had no Christian influence growing up. The more I did research into his parents, I discovered through the census that they had actually been divorced at some point. And he lived with his father for a while. And his parents, even though they weren't Christians, he said they taught him, you know, how to be respectful towards women and how to, you know, have good hygiene and so on and so forth. In high school, he really excelled and graduated near the top of his class at a large Philadelphia high school. And in high school, he dated a girl who was United Presbyterian, and she took him to her church. But even after going there, he didn't understand the Christian faith. And the summer after he graduated from high school, he ran to one of his junior high PE teachers, and he asked, you know, what do you think I should do next? And the junior high PE teacher told him, well, why don't you go down to the Philadelphia School of the Bible? And so he did that. He went on a tour there, and he met with the dean, and the dean explained the gospel to him. And Gerstner said that when he left the school that day, as he was walking down the steps of that school, that Bible college, that's where things all, you know, made sense for him. And he committed his life to Christ on those steps. And after that, he attended this UP church, and through that church, and he took some summer courses at that Philadelphia College of Law, but he, through the influence of this church, they sent him out to Westminster College in Western Pennsylvania. And it was there that he came in contact with a theologian, a philosopher named John Orr, who was kind of an evangelical Presbyterian theologian and philosopher who had been a student of Warfield and Machen. And Orr became Gerstner's spiritual father for the rest of, for many, many years. Orr died in the early 80s. And so he went to Westminster College there, and Orr taught that regeneration precedes faith, and that created some issues for Gerstner initially, but after some prayer and reading Hodge and Edwards, the Reformed faith made more sense to John Gerstner. And so then he did really well in college, finished near the top of his class, went for a little bit to the UP seminary in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, but he didn't feel like it was solid enough in terms of Reformed theology. So he transferred to Westminster Seminary, and that's where he graduated from with two degrees. And then there he had classes, you know, with Cornelius Van Til, but didn't really agree with Van Til's apologetic method. John Orr had a more evidentialist approach, and Orr, what doesn't get brought up too much about Orr is he did publish one book, English Deism, Its Roots and Fruits, which was published in 1934 by Erdmans. So if you want to understand Orr and how he differs with Van Til, that might be one thing to look at. But Van Til did write a review of Orr's book, and he did, you know, compliment it. But there just, you know, were some different apologetic views there. And Gerstner seemed to side more with his college professor. And then as he was ending his time at Westminster Seminary, he asked Paul Woolley, you know, what should I do in terms of continuing my studies? And Paul Woolley told him to go to Harvard, and Gerstner got accepted there and did a dissertation at Harvard on James McCosh. So they're kind of, you know, more evidentialist approach there too. But McCosh, I think, really helped Gerstner deal with some big issues within the field of philosophy in terms of how to deal with Immanuel Kant, how to deal with Charles Darwin, you know. And so So Gerstner had wrote his dissertation on Mikosh, and then after that became a UPCNA pastor in the Pittsburgh area for 5 years.
Because you mentioned Mikosh and Gerstner's dissertation, maybe you could unpack for us a little bit, because in the book, and you just mentioned it now, Gerstner is kind of doing a triangulation here between Scottish common sense realism, Mikosh, and evolution. How, I've not read the dissertation, so I'm not familiar with Gerstner's thesis exactly in there, but that's an interesting kind of triangulation, especially if you think about old Princeton's interaction with evolutionism, and sort of it's kind of, it rejected a Darwinian, atheistic, even deistic type of approach to evolution. But some have kind of, you know, said old Princeton, maybe because of its common sense realism, opened the door to theistic, a theistic type of evolution. So I'm just wondering, how did Gerstner kind of deal with those issues, and how did he end up coming down on the relationship between common sense realism, Darwinianism, evolutionism, and Mikosh?
Well, from the dissertation itself, I get the, you know, I think Gerstner really did not think that, he obviously rejected the naturalism of Darwin, and would not agree with that. And but I think, you know, Mikosh didn't see some of this stuff as problematic as other scholars did. He just thought in terms of, you know, that all this was question begging, in terms of what's the source of all this you know, this evolution that Darwin's talking about. There has to be something behind it. It can't, you know, and so Mikosh reasoned that it was God behind this. And so I think, you know, that, you know, there's lots of debate about all of this, obviously, amongst, you know, Christian scholars and theologians and philosophers. But Mikosh didn't think that it was as much of a threat as other, you know, like, you know, fundamentalists did. And so Gerstner, you know, he wrote on it in his dissertation. He does not talk a lot about science and other, you know, in his later writings. But I think, you know, a good book on this would be the Gundlach book on Process and Providence, the evolution question at Princeton. I think the real concern that John Gerstner and Mikosh and Machen and Warfield had, you know, with evolution is the kind of the natural, you know, the naturalistic philosophy behind it.
Right. Do you think Gerstner was sympathetic with a certain form, maybe a Princetonian form of theistic evolution?
Well, you know, that's maybe at some level, but that's, you know, there's lots of debates now about, you know, can Warfield even be regarded as a theistic evolutionist? Oftentimes he is, but I, you know, like Fred Zaspel has been making arguments, you know, contrary to that. Other scholars like David Livingston at Queen's University of Belfast, you know, and Mark Knoll are, you know, argue that Warfield, you know, was more of a theistic, you know, evolutionist with exceptions and caveats. But I don't think the Darwin part of it or the evolution part of it really doesn't factor too much into Gerstner's later career or his writings. But he did deal with it in the dissertation.
What's amazing to me about what the book brings out is the broad array of subjects that Gerstner was, you know, at least conversant with. So a question about Van Til and Gerstner, because, and this is early on in his career, he interacts some with Van Til's book, The New Modernism. You have page 48 of your book brings that out. Obviously Gerstner and Van Til had their differences on apologetic method, but I think Gerstner and Van Til had at least this in common. I mean, they had a lot more in common, I think, than they had not in common. And one of the things that they had in common was a mutual concern about the theology of Karl Barth. So how did, while Gerstner may have disagreed with Van Til, I guess, on apologetics, was Gerstner at all appreciative of Van Til's work on Barth? And how did Gerstner view Van Til's read of Karl Barth? Maybe that's a good way to put the question to you.
For Gerstner, and many, you know, people who are evangelicals in the mainline church, they see Van Til, you know, as an ally, as someone who's an Orthodox Christian, even though they may disagree, you know, on apologetic method and so forth. But I do, you know, thinking back on this issue, I think that Gerstner felt that maybe Van Til went a little bit too far in his criticisms of Karl Barth. I think, you know, Gerstner would definitely want to criticize Barth in many ways, but maybe he felt that Van Til took it a little too far and didn't recognize some of the positive things coming out of Karl Barth and his theology. So I think that's kind of how he looked at it. He did, you know, obviously he worked with Karl Barth's son at Pittsburgh Seminary. Karl Barth's son was a professor of theology at Pittsburgh Seminary.
Marcus, and right?
Marcus Barth. And Marcus was somewhat helpful and sympathetic to John Gerstner on the faculty. And you know, Gerstner had very few allies, you know, on the faculty. So it is somewhat interesting that Marcus Barth was, you know, more sympathetic to John Gerstner's concerns. But obviously, you know, maybe one way to think about it is, like Harold Lindzell's Battle for the Bible. Carl Henry said that was like, you know, theological atom bombing or whatever, and that Lindzell, you know, took it a little bit too far in his critique. And so maybe that's a way to compare how Gerstner felt about Van Til's critique of Barth.
It's interesting to me, Jeff, just to think about Gerstner's personal constitution, his personality. And one thing that stuck out to me as I, you know, was reading through your book is his resolve and his commitment to fight for what he believed was true and what I believe is true as well. Yet at the same time, that a fight that was fought in the midst of a lot of loneliness and isolation. And Gerstner had allies, you know, in other places. He wasn't entirely alone. And of course, you know, in the body of Christ, we have a great cloud of witnesses as well. But a lot of his fights, you know, it's not as if he was coming from a united faculty fighting against a Barth who, you know, is overseas. You know, somebody out there who's largely influential. So in that regard, you know, the Van Til is coming from a position where he's writing against Barth, but, you know, in the midst of an entire faculty who would, you know, for in large measure is going to agree with his critiques. But Gerstner, you know, in many ways is kind of doing his own thing from within his own faculty. Yeah, even had a story there where he was surprised. I mean, he had another person, perhaps a little bit more sympathetic on faculty. But when Gerstner was traveling, I think overseas, he read in the paper or news in the paper came out in the Pittsburgh Gazette that the man resigned at a private meeting, and he didn't have many people around him, did he? I mean, immediately around him, helping him out and really carrying on the fight with him.
Yeah, those are all good points. I think, you know, the loss of Addison Leach.
That's right.
Yeah. 1961, you know, was a tremendous blow because Leach was, you know, an evangelical theologian. And he had previously been the main theology professor and then also president of Pittsburgh Xenia Seminary, which was the only seminary of the UPCNA. You know, one thing that your OPC listeners might be interested in is, you know, Gerstner and other UPCNA people, you know, the UPCNA was not the mainline church. There was no need for them to to leave the mainline church because they simply weren't in it.
And they were called, we should say, I mean, for the, it's probably worthwhile to mention to people that part of the Presbyterian family tree, they were called the United Reformed Presbyterian Church. I'm getting that messed up, but they were called United because they were a merger, a previous merger of Associate Reformed, correct?
Yeah, back in 1858.
Right.
And so then, you know, when Gerstner joined the faculty of Pitt Xenia, you know, Addison Leach was the leading theologian, and a few years after that, he became president, but they were trying to make, you know, Pitt Xenia more conservative, more evangelical, and they were having some success in that. They were aligning themselves with, you know, Christianity Today magazine, and that was, you know, just, you know, setting off alarm bells amongst the PCUSA leadership because they did not want to have another Fuller seminary, you know, on the East Coast, you know, of the United States. And so that's, Gerstner believes that's what led the PCUSA officials to swiftly move for, you know, merger of the denominations. Because then if those two denominations merge, then they could consolidate Pitt Xenia Seminary with Western in Pittsburgh. And that's ultimately what did happen. And then, you know, the evangelical Pitt Xenia, you know, faculty, you know, they were, you know, taken over basically by a more liberal seminary, and that's what Addison Leach was.
So 2 or 3 years after that is when he resigned.
Well, he resigned, twice. He resigned from the presidency of Pitt Xenia right as they were consolidating. And then he took a one-year sabbatical. They gave him a one-year sabbatical. Then he came back and taught at the joint, the new consolidated Pittsburgh Seminary, and the liberalism was just too much for him.
Right.
And so he resigned in protest, and that was a front-page story in the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. You know, and Addison Leach was really revered in the UPCNA, so this was a big deal. Now, this story, however, does not, it's not in any of the Pittsburgh Seminary history books. And it really should be. And, you know, I discuss and analyze it in my book, and there's a historian at Indiana University of Pennsylvania who's pointed this out as well in a review of the Walther volume on Pittsburgh Seminary. He complained that this, you know, this situation with Addison Leach isn't even mentioned, and in terms of the reasons why he resigned. So, you know, what we have going on here is we have an extension of the Machen controversy.
Mm-hmm, certainly.
And even Leach's father-in-law, from what I remember my research, had some association with Machen. So Machen's influence in the UPCNA is kind of manifest here in some of these battles that happen with the merger and then the consolidation of the seminaries. And the reason Gerstner didn't resign was because he felt that if he resigned, there weren't going to be any conservative voices and it would just be a total, you know, onslaught of liberalism. And so he wanted to stay there and try to be a positive, you know, reformed evangelical witness. And he did that to the best of his ability. And there were some other evangelical faculty there. Bob Kelly, who was a New Testament professor, was, you know, sympathetic to Gerstner, not as militant, but, you know, sympathetic evangelical. And then also there was a biblical archaeologist that ended his career in kind of the mid-60s, who was more evangelical too, and his name was James Kelso, and he retired in about 64. So there just were, you know, some retirements and obviously Addison Leach, you know, departing. And so the evangelical minority faculty members, that number depleted pretty swiftly after the consolidation. But Gerstner wanted to stay and you know, be an evangelical witness.
And certainly you could, I imagine, sympathize. I know I can to some degree, having been born into the UPC UNA and, or the UPC USA, I should say. And then in 83, when I was three, becoming the PC USA, as it's known now, as it merged with the PC US, or what's often called the Southern Presbyterian Church. My parents' church, my parents are now in the OPC because they have left and they've joined with the OP congregation several years ago. But the church where I grew up left the PC USA for the EPC, which you mentioned that you've had that experience in your family as well. And there's always this desire, or there's always a voice, and it's a good voice, but a voice of people saying, well, let's try to stay and influence, you know, the church for the better. And there are conservative voices who seek to band together and try to prevent the church from moving in a liberal direction. The same was true when the OPC was formed in 1936, breaking off from the Presbyterian Church USA to form a new denomination. And certainly that voice was present in the 50s and 60s, 70s, 80s. It's been there for many, many years. So we could sympathize with different people. And also, I imagine with Gerstner's desire to remain for so long in what is considered a mainline church after it had merged several times, to fight for the truth and to prevent the church from moving in a liberal direction. But at some point, it just becomes a lost cause. And where that line is, and where the right time to leave is a really a hard question and a matter of conscience, and a lot of prayer needs to go into that.
Yeah, and I think I think everything you said is accurate, and I agree with it. But what I try to show in the book is that, you know, even though Gerstner's marginalized, even though he loses, you know, one ecclesiastical battle after the next, these contribute to kind of a growing concern.
Sure.
You know, in kind of a growing what I call Presbyterian Reformed Evangelicalism. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you in the 70s, you get the start of the Ascension Presbyterian Western Pennsylvania, which is a PCA presbytery. You know, R.C. Sproul leaves the mainline church and helps. You know, gets involved in that movement. You get, you know, they're upset with what's going on at Pittsburgh Seminary. They're losing, you know, all these battles. So they start Ligonier Valley Study Center, which becomes Ligonier Ministries. You get, you know, people upset with the Wynn Kenyon decision, and that, you know, gets people into the PCA. And then you have the Mansfield-Casement decision in the late 70s, early 80s, and that leads to the founding of the EPC. And so, even though Gerstner lost a lot of these battles, there are many people that are agreeing with him. And the positive side of losing these battles is that it creates this, I think, kind of conservative Presbyterian momentum to found new institutions.
Kind of galvanizes
new
them.
Mm-hmm. New organizations. And so I think we need to remember that as we think of all these losses, that positive thing, you know, positive things are coming out of some of these losses. It's not wholly negative. And oftentimes, you know, if you look at the OPC or if you look at, you know, Machen, you know, you think OPC is so small, but it's had a tremendous influence. You know, think about, you know, Gerstner going to Westminster Seminary as a UPCNA person and taking that message back into the UPCNA and the UPC. I mean, it just, you know, I think that the movement that Machen started really, you know, it has grown and has strengthened, and the PCUSA is in decline.
Yeah.
But I will say that one of the things going on in the PCSA right now, and I know many of the renewal leaders and was involved in the renewal movements, is that there's a lot of discussion, you know, about Machen right now. And I've, you know, even talked to PCUSA officials saying, you know, you really need to rethink, you know, Machen, and many of them have said to me, very prominent one said to me recently that, you know, Machen, he really disagreed with Machen's, style and his attitude about things, but his arguments really have been in many ways proven right. Mm-hmm. And it's hard to, I think, to see it any other way.
Mm-hmm. Right. Gerstner is, and it comes out so clear in the book, is a very unique character in the 20th century in what you're calling evangelical reform Presbyterianism. He's not what we might call a neo-evangelical, right? He's not quite in that camp. And I always think of a neo-evangelical as sort of a fundamentalist minus the bad scholarship. Okay. So, so neo-evangelicals were like, you know, fundamentalists with a brain. And they were self-conscious about wanting to engage at the highest scholarly level, oftentimes falling short. And that comes out in your book. I think you quote from Mark Knoll, or it was either Knoll or Marsden, who was making comments about a book that was a compilation of articles. And basically the comment was, except for this one article, the rest weren't very good scholarship. And I think that Gerstner is very, very unique because he was able to run with the best of them. He was he went to Harvard, but when it came down to brass tacks and he did his best scholarship, and he was writing on the scholarly level, he showed himself, he proved himself to be able to think with the best that's out there. And yet he was still, of course, marginalized in many respects. But I guess maybe this raises a question for me, which is, maybe you can unpack for us how it was. So let me back up and give a historical preface, right? At the time after Westminster, the time immediately after Westminster was founded in 1929, a lot of Westminster grads were not only marginalized, but they were just blackballed. I mean, you weren't, if you were a graduate of Westminster, if you were a disciple of Machen's, you were not going to get a call in the PCUSA, generally speaking, nor were you going to get you weren't going to get a post in any type of academic setting that is surrounded with the, you know, with the influence of the PCUSA. How is it that Gerstner has a remarkable amount of career advancement, if I could put it that way, as a graduate of Westminster? He's got 2 degrees from Westminster Seminary, and of course he's got the doctorate from Harvard, but how is it that, is it simply because Gerstner is running in more conservative circles, the UPC, or what? I mean, how is it that he gets the posts and the positions he does, even though he's probably marked very early on as a disciple, as a Machenite, if we could put it that way?
Yeah, well, I think what we need to keep in mind is that, you know, many people within the UPCNA agreed with Machen. And in fact, in the 30s, there was a merger negotiation attempt by the PCUSA, you know, to get the UPCNA to join them. And the UPCNA did not do it because of their concerns of the Auburn Affirmation and liberal theology. So the UPCNA was more willing to accept graduates of Westminster Seminary, and there were a number of them that came from Westminster, you know, into the UPCNA ministry, and Gerstner was one of those. And then there was, you know, an effort to strengthen and make the UP Seminary more conservative. And so that's, you know, you have Addison Leach coming and Gerstner. And so, you know, I think a lot of this goes back to, you know, an organization that Machen founded, the League of Evangelical Students. And you know, when Machen when that was first being launched in 1925, there was no other PCUSA seminary that would join and be a part of that organization. But there was one UPCNA seminary that was willing to be a part of it, and the president of that seminary was on the board of the LES. There was only five professors on that board, and it was Machen and Melvin Grove Kyle, president of Xenia. And so Machen and Robert Dick Wilson, one of the things that they did is they developed these relationships with these scholars from Xenia, and those relationships, I think, you know, contributed to the more conservative and evangelical ethos of the UPCNA.
What's amazing about Gerstner then in this setting is the fact are a couple of factors. I mean, he's an academic who is operating at the highest intellectual scholarly level, and yet he very quickly, after accomplishing his academic goals, becomes somewhat of a popularizer of the Reformed faith and of Christianity. This is sort of taken forward by Sproul, right? So he meets Sproul, and you got the Ligonier thing going on, and Sproul brings Gerstner in to begin teaching classes and all of that stuff. So Gerstner kind of has an interesting role where he's able to exercise his intellectual gifts and his scholarly gifts, but he's able to do it in a setting with a popular audience, sort of speak. Maybe you could talk a little bit about that. How does Gerstner, or maybe better yet, why does Gerstner get involved in popular type of ministry, not dumbing down, but taking all of his intellectual gifts and the richness of the Reformed faith and Reformed theology and being able to then minister it to a popular audience in both books and lecture format? And then the way in which that leads to his connection with Sproul and Ligonier Ministries, maybe you could take us kind of through that history and unpack that as you find useful.
Yeah, well, they founded the Ligonier Valley Study Center in the early 70s, and it just, you know, really mushroomed and grew, and they you know, had some you know, really important financial backing from a wealthy woman in the Pittsburgh area, and that kind of got it launched. And then and then right off the bat, they were able to get some really good people, you know, who had really good tech knowledge and were able to, you know, film and record lectures and things like that. And so then they were able to distribute that, you know, throughout the United States and around the world. And that's, you know, really what helped Ligonier grow. I think too, you know, within the UPCNA tradition itself, there is a more populist orientation. You see it especially in James Orr, who is the most prominent UP theologian, you know, of the end of the 19th, early 20th century. Orr was, you know, as learned as you could get, but he spent the last few years of his career as a popularizer. And the UP tradition is more focused on the common people. It was a much poorer denomination compared to the mainline church. The UP church in Scotland and in the United States was much poorer. And so they just had a populist bent and style to them. So I think what Sproul, you know, did and what Gerstner did can be connected to James Orr. And then Orr too is very close to Melvin Grove Kyle, and Kyle had a very populist orientation as well.
That's interesting. That's an interesting connection. I never understood that, and how much the background of the UP and the culture of the UP goes into the person of Gerstner is a remarkable story in and of itself, isn't it?
Yeah. And I think the UPCNA tradition is far more important for Presbyterian history, far more important for evangelical history than has previously been realized, because Orr was the one who planted the seed in Carl Henry's mind to really, work on kind of large scale, philosophical issues and try to develop a Christian worldview and so on and so forth. So Orr, doesn't get a lot of credit, but I think is someone who's really, really important for the history of evangelicalism and for, kind of this populist approach to things.
Right. So if I could just ask you about, maybe we would wrap up with these couple of things, but a couple of controversies, you mentioned them already, but maybe give you some time to unpack them some. Talk a little bit about the Kenyon case and Gerstner's role in it, and if you could tack on to the end of that, if you would, what were Gerstner's thoughts and opinions about female pastors, women pastors in the denomination?
When Kenyon, his family came from the UPCNA. His father was very close to Gerstner, and so they, he went to Marietta College and he came to Pittsburgh Seminary. Gerstner was his mentor, and then right as he was going for ordination in the mainline Presbyterian Church, the presbytery voted to allow it. Pittsburgh Presbytery did. It was kind of a close vote, but they voted to allow it. But that vote was appealed by one of the members of the presbytery, and there was a professor a more liberal professor at Pittsburgh Seminary who helped that pastor file the appeal against Win Kenyon, and then Gerstner defended Kenyon in the Senate, at the Synod level, and then at the General Assembly level, but they lost those appeals. And Kenyon was willing to work with women pastors in the denomination. He was willing, he wasn't trying to say the denomination couldn't allow women pastors. He just said that he himself personally could not be involved in their ordination. And so they ruled against Kenyon, and they said he could not be ordained. And so that was a big, controversy within the mainline church. And that's where you have the ruling that, in order to be ordained in the PCSA, you have to affirm women's ordination. One of the things I just discovered a few weeks ago, that I did not know about was that one of the things that the PCSA leadership did to get the UPCNA to join in 1958 was, they promised that they wouldn't have to allow for women's ordination. So, that's what they, said in 1958 in order to get this smaller group to join them. And then, 17 years later or whatever, they changed that policy. And so, I think, Gerstner did not agree with women's ordination. When Kenyon, did not agree with it. They didn't think that it was, you could make a biblical case for it, but they were not arguing that that there couldn't be women ministers in the denomination. They were just saying that was their personal view, and they wrote a pamphlet on it along with R.C. Sproul, and I have copies of that. So they were kind of they were trying to be tolerant in this situation, and then they were just totally, dealt with, I think, in a very severe and they were not dealt with in the right way. And so that's when you start getting churches leaving, the mainline church in the mid-70s there and going to the PCA. especially in the Western Pennsylvania region.
And lastly, if you would talk about the Caseman case and Gerstner's role involved, that's a fascinating story in itself.
Yeah, well, Mansfield Caseman was previously had been a United Church of Christ pastor, and then in the late 70s, he was going to a joint UCC-PCUSA church in Maryland. And so this was the National Capital Union Presbytery of the mainline churches, so to speak. And so then they asked him at his ordination exam, is Jesus God? And he said, no, God is God. And that, set off a firestorm within the denomination, and charges were filed against him. And then in the newspaper, he denied the bodily resurrection of Jesus Christ. And so Gerstner and, there was various charges filed. But what's interesting about the charges, I looked into the people that filed them, and these were people who had previously been UPCNA pastors. So I think you have that UP connection again, and Gerstner tried to prosecute Mansfield Caseman, at the Presbytery, Synod, General Assembly levels, and he lost all of those cases. And that was the event that led to the founding of the EPC. Bartlett Hess, the pastor of Ward Presbyterian in Detroit, said enough with this, and so then they. Bartlett Hess got the EPC started along with Andrew Jumper from, I think it was Central Presbyterian Church in St. Louis. And so the EPC starts off with 12 churches and now has over 650 churches.
Wow. I'm wondering, Jeff, for those who are not entirely familiar with Gerstner, of course, who want them to read your book and become familiar with the history. But I'm wondering if there is just a real, accessible entree, perhaps even by Gerstner himself. What would you recommend to folks who'd like to follow up and become more familiar with his thoughts and either read something he wrote or perhaps watch one of his courses? Where would you point them?
Yeah, well, he wrote lots of books. He wrote Theology for the Layman. He wrote Jonathan Edwards' A Mini Theology. Those are more accessible mm-hmm. books. He wrote a book called Reasons for Faith. He wrote a interesting book on a theology of the sex, and that's a really fascinating book because he deals with all the cults, and each chapter, like the first chapter, is the one that's the sect or cult that's closest to Christianity. And so he has I think the first one is, his Seventh-day Adventist, and it's Jehovah's Witnesses or Mormons. I can't remember the exact order, but he has, I'm pretty sure he has Jehovah's Witnesses and Mormons ahead of, he has a chapter on theological liberals. And he wrote that, in the early 60s as the two seminaries were coming together, and he believes and he makes the argument that theological liberalism is a different religion than Orthodox Christianity, and he goes into
sounds
the whole discussion
good to me.
Of Machen and Christianity and liberalism.
Yeah.
So your readers might, if they're interested in Machen, they might be interested in that book.
I wonder if the communications team wrote him some letters and said, would you mind, you're making our PR job harder. Could you not write anymore, Dr. Gerstner?
Yeah, well, he did not hide or conceal his conservative, Presbyterian beliefs, and he wasn't, he wasn't going to compromise with the liberals, and he never did.
Absolutely.
So I think he's kind of a heroic figure in that respect. But I do think he's a much better speaker. He's a much better lecturer than he was a writer. And I think that's really where his fame is. It was in his speaking and getting people excited about Reformed theology and Jonathan Edwards. And so I think that the video lectures of him that are online now, those are probably, people probably find those more stimulating than his writings.
Sure. Can you find them? I know Ligonier produces and still distributes a lot of resources, and I think there might be some available on YouTube as well. You just do a search on Gerstner and find some things?
Yeah, you Ligonier a few months ago put up hundreds of videos, John Gerstner videos, of all sorts of areas of church history and then different areas of apologetics. And so, you know, if you type in Gerstner's name to Google, you know, he'll get, you know, hundreds of thousands of hits or whatever. And then if you type in like another prominent theologian, and it's nowhere near what you get for Sproul and Gerstner. So the popular appeal, I think, is, you know, is really important to understand. It's not that Gerstner was the best Edwards scholar. He really wasn't, but he's important because he got so many lay people interested in Edwards.
Mm-hmm. No, that's really tremendous. There's so much there. I mean, we really only scratched the surface, if even that, of this monograph. So I really want the people listening to follow up and get a copy of it. Again, it's published by Pickwick Publications. And it's within the Princeton Theological Monograph Series. The title, for those interested, and I'll have this in the episode description, John Gerstner and the Renewal of Presbyterian and Reformed Evangelicalism in Modern America, came out just a couple years ago. And it's written by our guest today, Jeffrey S. McDonald. Jeff, it's been such a pleasure to speak with you. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, well, we hope to follow up and talk more about this and other issues. And of course, if listeners want to follow up, you can check us out online at reformedforum.org. There you'll also find information about all of our programs and our events that are upcoming and different projects and things we have in the pipeline. If you'd like to get in touch with us, you can send us an email, mail@reformedforum.org. I just got that down to inbox zero. Can you believe it? I had to work through about 600 emails. I've kind of resumed responsibility of the overseeing and being a steward of the email inbox, and it took me a while, but we're good there. So if you'd like to send a note or you have a question or something, we'll do our best to be responsive. You can also send us a tweet at Reformed Forum or follow us on Facebook or interact with us on our page. But, of course, keep listening. And we want to thank you all for listening. We hope you join us again next time on Christ the Center.